Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop from Washington. I am your host, Mark Levine. I am back at the nation's capital at live from the Center for American Progress. And, I just came back from my first political experience, I guess. Now, I'm not quite a legislator yet. I am a, one reporter called me, I'm a proto-delegate-elect. See, I'll be a delegate-elect in November, but because I'm not running against any opposition, I'm a proto-delegate-elect because it is very likely I will win against all the non-existent write-in candidates in November. I did fight a very difficult primary race in June, but once that race is over, it's pretty much smooth sailing. In any case, I was in Richmond, Virginia, just on Monday, and the governor called us into special session. I reported on it on Monday. But basically, the governor said that he had to obey a court order, which he did, a federal court order, that ruled that Virginia's 3rd congressional district was so packed with black people that black people didn't have sufficient representation outside of the district. That this gerrymandering, this intentional racial gerrymandering by Republicans in the Commonwealth of Virginia, had gone so far that it was a violation of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. So the special session was ordered by the governor as required by the court. The Democrats came in. They had their plan, a plan to basically give Virginia a purple state, purple representation, purple meaning equal red and blue. Virginia has elected only Democrats statewide for the last several years. That's why we have, in my home state, a Democratic governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, both state senators, and yes, we voted for Barack Obama, both in 2008 and 2012. But despite that, we have a congressional delegation that is 8-3 Republican because of gerrymandering, because of partisan gerrymandering and racial gerrymandering, whereby the Republicans packed as many blacks as they could into a congressional district that stretches from the state capital, Richmond, all the way for hundreds of miles down to the southeastern corner of the state, picking up suburbs of Richmond and Petersburg and Norfolk and Newport News and Hampton. And if you look at all the if you look at a map of Virginia, you'll see it's kind of a line along the river. In fact, it goes along the river for 100 miles or so with no districts. Unless you live on a houseboat, you can't be in the district. One of the things I'd like to see in a gerrymandering law, I'd like to see you not go along the coast as they do in Florida or along the river as you do in Virginia. I think if you don't have a bridge crossing that water divide, then maybe the districts shouldn't cross that water divide. If there's no way to get from one part of the district to another part of the district without swimming on a raft for hundreds of miles, then maybe those districts are not quite contiguous enough. In any case, and again, I gave a longer report on Monday, the Republicans decided to use that session not to actually follow the court order. They had no plan for redistricting whatsoever. The Democrats had one. The Republicans didn't. Instead, they wanted to use it to do something that hadn't been done in more than a century, to remove a sitting Supreme Court justice, Virginia Supreme Court justice, because they were mad at the Democratic governor. It all became a pretty partisan food fight. And I must say I'm impressed with one Republican senator, one outgoing Republican senator. And this Republican senator decided that he'd had enough. He had enough of violating century-old traditions in Virginia just to win a political war of the moment. And so John Watkins, a moderate Republican senator, voted with the 19 Democrats in the Virginia State Senate to reject firing, in essence, this current Supreme Court justice that had just been appointed by the governor, and then voted to adjourn. Now, there's still partisan battles. There's a question because the Senate has adjourned and the House hasn't adjourned, and I'm going to be sitting in the House, but I'm okay because, like I said, I'm not a delegate quite yet. And in fact, the state capitol is empty today, and I'm back here in Washington, D.C. But I got my first taste, my first time sitting on the floor of a legislative body in session with the idea that I would soon be sitting as a delegate. Now, to be fair, I did sit on the floor in Congress when I worked for Congressman Barney Frank as a staffer, as his chief counsel on the Hill. But it was a different experience, actually, feeling like, wow, I'll soon be pushing those buttons, that green and red button. Anyway, one of the reasons I'm telling you this is, one, hey, I just got back from a unique experience. I want to tell you about that. But also to give you an idea of what it's like for a politician to try to understand and to have some sympathy for what all the politicians go through. Because I know that politicians are some of the least liked people in the country. Probably down there around, lower than lawyers, and I've been a lawyer. In fact, the only one probably lower than politicians is lobbyists, something I will never be. But I was thinking about all the difficulties that politicians have, and a lot of it has to do with money. We can talk about that later on, but specifically about policies and about confrontations. We talked last week about the Black Lives Matter movement and how it confronted Bernie Sanders running for president and how he handled that confrontation. And I actually don't think he handled it particularly well. I think he conceded the floor too much to them. Not that the concerns aren't valid, but that I don't think you should allow people to hijack your forum, whether good people or bad people. I mean, when I think of all the wonderful groups that I support, from the NAACP to Planned Parenthood to environmentalist groups like the Sierra Club to unions. I support all these groups, civil rights organizations, gay rights organizations, women's rights organizations, Latino organizations. I mean, I can think of a whole large group of people that I support, but I wouldn't want them, each of them, to take over my stage and talk for 10 minutes when it's my turn to speak. Just like they wouldn't want me to go to their events, even though I agree with them, and jump up on stage and hijack it when it's their turn to speak. We talked about that last week. But I thought when the Black Lives Matter movement came to Hillary Clinton, I thought she gave them some very useful political knowledge. Some very useful political advice. And there's a wonderful video that shows the Black Lives Matter movement confronting Hillary Clinton. Apparently they came too late to her rally. The Secret Service barred their entry. It was already full, but they did have a chance to meet with her backstage and tell them their concerns. And their concerns are real. There are concerns. I do have it, and I was actually going to play it very soon, Mark. Their concerns are real, and they're my concerns, and I think they should be your concerns. And they're the concerns of violence. The concerns that police officers kill unarmed black people at 7 times the rate they kill unarmed white people in the same situations. Now, that's not something I think that could be ascribed to chance or poverty or criminal records or anything else. At some point when you get 7-1, it's got to be something to do with race. And the speaker comes up to Hillary Clinton and goes in quite some detail about the history of American racism, all the things that obviously Hillary Clinton knows really well. And she says, she agrees with him, as he goes on and on, pointedly and correctly, about America's racist history, going all the way back to slavery. Well, here, I'll play just a little bit of what he has to say. And then after the break, I want to play what Hillary Clinton responded to. But let's just listen to him for just a little bit. Let's turn the sound on here.
That we can actually take on anti-blackness as a founding problem in this country. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that there's going to be a solution mm-hmm. because what the conversations that are happening now and why there's so much cohesion across the divide, the red side and the blue side, is because of money. Right? We spend a lot of money on prisons. Mm-hmm. We spend more money on prisons than we are on schools. Right? But if we look at it from a lens of let's solve this financial problem and we don't look at the greater bottom line that African Americans who are Americans are suffering at greater rates than most other people, every other people for the length of this country, then it's not going to go away. It's just going to morph into something new and evolved. And I genuinely want to know, you and your family have been in
this oil
partially responsible for it. It's more than most.
Let's take a break, and we'll get back to his response, to her response, to his response. He basically goes on to say that Bill Clinton signed
now,
the crime bill.
There may have been unintended consequences.
And that therefore, you know, what's Hillary's response? What's she going to do about it? I think she gave him a very interesting response, and it tells us a lot about how to build a movement, and I'll get right back to it right after this.
He's a Fulbright scholar, and he speaks French, but he couldn't tell you who won the Super Bowl. It's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275. And now, the voice of reason in an unreasonable world, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. One of the things I've learned as someone who's worked inside and outside of politics, as someone who has led political protests and done marches on Washington and other places, is that it's not enough to do a march. This is actually something Barney Frank, my old boss, used to say. Don't go to a protest rally, join in a march, listen to the inspiring speeches, maybe speak yourself, clap, cheer, wave your signs, and go home. Because even though that made you feel good, you haven't accomplished anything. The way to accomplish something in a movement, the way to change the way things are, the way to make a difference, folks. Well, one is, you know, do what I do. Get elected. Join the government. Or two, work for someone in the government to make a difference in that way. Okay. But if you're not going to do that, if you want to work from outside the government, which is perfectly fine, heck, something I did for 20 years or so now, you got to have an agenda. You can't just complain about the way things are. You have to have an idea of where you want to go, of how you want to see the world change. Because unless you have a specific positive place for people to go, people will say, oh, yeah, you're right. That's a terrible, terrible thing. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. And then they'll go about their daily lives. After the activist, the Black Lives Matter activist, spoke to Hillary Clinton and said basically all the harm that's going on, which she agrees with, doesn't dispute, and goes into how it's sort of an unbroken line to the racist history of America from its founding days, which, again, she doesn't dispute, he stops. And her point, her next point, is a crucial learning point for anyone, for any progressive, anyone who wants to get something changed. And that is, okay, problem mentioning is the first step, but the second step is a solution, is an agenda. And I thought she put it quite well. This is all her backstage. This isn't a speech. This is her discussion with an activist that was recorded. Here's what she says.
So we've got limited time.
Well, obviously, it's a very thoughtful question that deserves a thoughtful answer. And I can only tell you that I feel very committed to and responsible for doing whatever I can. I've spent most of my adult life focused on kids through the Children's Defense Fund and other efforts to try to give kids, particularly poor kids, particularly, you know, black kids and Hispanic kids, the same chance to live up to their own God-given potential as any other kid. That's where I've been focused. And I think that there has to be a reckoning. I agree with that. But I also think there has to be some positive vision and plan that you can move people toward. I mean, once you say, you know, this country has still not recovered from its original sin, mm-hmm. which is true, once you say that, then the next question by people who are on the sidelines, which is the vast majority of Americans, the next question is, well, so what do you want me to do about it? What am I supposed to do about it? That's what I'm trying to put together in a way that I can explain it and I can sell it. Because in politics, if you can't explain it and you can't sell it, it stays on the shelf. And this is now a time, a moment in time, just like the civil rights movement or the women's movement or the gay rights movement or a lot of other movements reached a point in time. The people behind that consciousness raising and advocacy, they had a plan ready to go. So that when you turn to, you know, the women's movement, we want to pass this and we want to pass that and we want to do this, problems are not all taken care of, we know that. Obviously, I know more about the civil rights movement in the old days because I had a lot of involvement in working with people. So they had a plan, this piece of legislation, this court case we're going to make, et cetera, et cetera. Same with the gay rights movement. You know, we're sick of homophobia, we're sick of being discriminated against, we want marriage equality, and we're starting in the states, and we're going to keep going until we get it at the highest court of the land. So all I'm saying is your analysis is totally fair. It's historically fair, it's psychologically fair, it's economically fair. But you're going to have to come together as a movement and say, here's what we want done about it. Because you can get lip service from as many white people as you can pack into Yankee Stadium and a million more like it, who are going to say, oh, we get it, we're going to be nicer, mm-hmm. okay? Mm-hmm. That's not enough, at least right. in my book. That's not how I see mm-hmm. politics. So the consciousness raising, the advocacy, the passion, the youth of your movement is so critical. But now all I'm suggesting is, even for us sinners, find some common ground on agendas that can make a difference right here and now in people's lives. And that's what I would love to, you know, have your thoughts about, because that's what I'm trying to figure out how to do. So yeah, deal with mass incarceration. It's not just an economic issue, although I grant you some people see it like that. But it's more than that. I think there is a sense like, you know, low-level offenders, disparity in treatment, we got to do something about that.
So hear what she's saying. Yes, it's important to complain. Yes, it's important to note the problem. But give me an agenda. How are we going to fix this? How are we going to fix mass incarceration? How are we going to dampen down the racial violence? We need a plan. I want to talk about that plan when we come back and hear from you what you think we should be done. 888-488-MARK. Right back after this.
Back to the Aggressive Progressive. Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. The reason I'm playing at length a video, kind of a grainy video that shows Hillary Clinton backstage after her speech talking with some Black Lives Matter people, some young people that approached her, is because, one, I want to talk about specifically the proposals that she has and what we specifically can do to stop the injustice, particularly the injustice between too many police officers and too many African Americans and too much mass incarceration, and discuss the specific proposals, which I'll get to in a minute. But also, just in general, emphasize that you need specific proposals, that it's never enough to complain. I don't care whether the issue is the healthcare system. right? Republicans complain on and on and on and on about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. Heck, I complain about it too. I don't think it's perfect. And when I tell you I don't think Obamacare, I don't think the Affordable Care Act is perfect or as good as it could be, and I mention its problems, which it has, I still think it's better than the system before it. But I give you a proposed solution. I say the better answer is universal care. The better answer is the answer that every other industrialized nation has. Every country, civilized nation, Western nation, industrialized nation in Europe has. England, France, Germany, the Netherlands, Belgium, Sweden, Norway, Switzerland, Italy, you name it. Or Canada, or Australia, or New Zealand, or frankly Costa Rica, which is a very nice country, but it's not a particularly Western or wealthy country. My point is, I give you an answer. I suggest a problem, I give you an answer. And you'll note that when Republicans attack Obamacare, they never tell you what they want to replace it with. Because it's easy to complain about a problem. It's much, much harder to design a better working system. Because generally the way things are the way things are because people haven't thought of ways to improve them. Now, there are always ways to improve them. Heck, I'm running for office because I think there's a way to improve the system. But it's very, very easy to complain. Not as easy to give an answer. And what Hillary Clinton is saying to these young activists is, I appreciate your being here. I appreciate what you have to say. I agree with what you have to say. You're making some really strong points here. But you need to give me some answers. And she goes on and she explains some of the suggestions of what an answer might look like.
So, yeah, deal with mass incarceration. It's not just an economic issue, although I grant you some people see it like that. But it's more than that. I think there is a sense like, you know, low-level offenders, disparity in treatment, we got to do something about that. I think that a lot of the issues about housing and about job opportunities, ban the box, a lot of these things, let's get an agenda that addresses as much of the problem as we can. Because then you can be for something, in addition to getting people to have to admit that they're part of a long history in our country of, either proposing, supporting, condoning discrimination, segregation, et cetera. Now, what do we do next? And that's what I'm trying to figure out in my campaign. So that's what I'm doing.
So there you go. So it's not just to get people to say the United States has a long history of racism. Frankly, you'd have to be either an idiot or an ideologue to deny the United States has a long history of racism. That's objectively true. We had slavery based on race. We had miscegenation laws, anti-marriage laws between blacks and whites based on race. We had segregation of schools and water fountains based on race. I mean, okay. To deny the history of racism in America, it'd be hard to find, frankly, a right winger to deny the history of racism in America. I also think it's damn hard to deny that racism currently exists today. I'm not saying everyone's racist. I'm not saying racism is everywhere. But it's in enough places that it's pretty ubiquitous throughout the United States of America. But Hillary's challenge is, what are you going to do about it? And what should I do about it? I'm running for president of the United States. She says, give me your agenda. Martin Luther King didn't leave it up to Lyndon Johnson to find the best solution. He said, I want a Voting Rights Act. I want you to get rid of poll taxes. I want you to get rid of these barriers of black people to vote. I want you to allow black people to drink at any water fountain they want to drink at and be served by any restaurant, any hotel, not be sent to the back of the bus. Specific proposals. And she talks about some of those specific proposals. Ending mass incarceration for drug crimes. Ban the box. You know what ban the box means? Many of you know. Not all of you may know. The box is a box on job applications that asks, have you ever been convicted of a crime? Many job applications, unless specifically banned by state law, ask prospective applicants if you've ever been convicted of a crime. If someone checks yes, many employers automatically, without further thought, discard those applications. I don't want next felon. Next. What Ban the Box as a movement says is if you ban the box, if you can't ask the question on a form, if you've got to look into someone's eyes as you ask the question. Ban the box, by the way, doesn't prohibit employers from asking that question. What it does do is say don't ask it a priori. Don't immediately throw out every ex-felon because maybe that person has a good reason. Particularly if the answer is arrested. You could be arrested for a crime you didn't commit. You could be unfairly arrested. Or you could be like a good friend of mine, someone who used to break into houses when he was 18. I've actually talked with him at length about this. It's very interesting to me. I had never really met anyone who had done that before. And I got to know this guy who's a very honorable, great guy. And he was very open about his past. He used to do that as a kid. He went to jail for a couple years. He got out. He served his time. He actually has a very respectable position right now where he's trusted to do things. He's gotten over his past, which was umpteen years ago. I'm not saying that employers shouldn't know that someone's committed a crime. They should. But do so in the context of having someone being able to explain their circumstances. And if they can't explain, they're not going to get the job. But she gives specific examples of things that can truly change lives. And what's interesting is there's a little bit of pushback on behalf of the activists who talk about changing hearts. And Hillary Clinton's very, very real. She keeps it real about how changing laws is even more important than changing hearts. That by changing laws, we can change hearts. I have no doubt that the marriage equality movement, of which I was one of the early founders, we changed hearts, minds, and laws. And they all work in tandem. And by changing laws, we did change people's minds. Heck, when Brown versus Board of Education became the law in 1954, the vast majority of white Americans still supported segregation. Sometimes the law is in advance of changing minds. But listen to this conflict. Listen to this exchange between Hillary Clinton and a Black Lives Matter activist on the difference between changing hearts and changing laws.
The piece that's most important, and I stand here in your space, and I say this as respectfully as I can, but if you don't tell Black people what we need to do, then we won't tell you all what you need to do.
Well, I'm not telling you. I'm just telling you to tell me.
What I mean to say is that...
See, he's saying, don't tell us to come up with an agenda. Don't tell Black people what to do. And we won't tell you what to do. Which I think is the wrong answer. She's not telling them what to do. She's asking them what they want her to do. Very, very different things. It's just interesting, this exchange.
This is and has always been a white problem of violence. It's not, there's not much that we can do to stop the violence against us.
Well, if that is
the conversation that pushed back.
Okay, I understand.
And
I understand what you're saying.
Also respectfully.
Yeah. Well, respectfully, if that is your position, then I will talk only to white people about how we are going to deal
That's
with the very
I mean.
Real
That's
problems.
That's not what I mean. That's not what I mean. No. But like what I'm saying is you what you just said mm-hmm. was a form of victim blaming, right? You were saying that what the Black Lives Matter movement needs to do to change white hearts is
No, I'm not talking about
policy.
Look,
change.
I don't believe you change hearts. I believe you change laws, you change allocation of resources, you change the way systems operate. You're not going to change every heart. You're not. But at the end of the day, we can do a whole lot to change some hearts and change some systems and create more opportunities for people who deserve to have them to live up to their own God-given potential, to live safely without fear of violence in their own communities, to have a decent school, to have a decent house, to have a decent future. So we can do it one of many ways. You know, you can keep the movement going, which you have started, and through it, you may actually change some hearts. But if that's all that happens, we'll be back here in 10 years having the same conversation. Julia, because we will not have all of the changes that you deserve to see happen in your lifetime because of your willingness to get out there and talk about this.
Thank you.
Thanks. We got to go this way.
Okay. So you heard her response. He's talking about changing hearts. She's talking about changing laws. Now, to be fair, I don't mean to overstate the conflict. Obviously, she wants to change hearts. Obviously, he wants to change laws. But, and I even understand what he's saying in the sense of, don't tell us, you know, we have to come up with an agenda. That's your job. You're the policymaker. But you know what? Policymakers need some help. There's a reason why when lobbyists approach us, and I now say us, because heck, lobbyists are approaching me now. There's a reason why when lobbyists approach policymakers, they don't just say, look out for this industry, look out for these people, look out for these ideas matter. They don't. They come up with real, concrete suggestions. Sometimes they're more than concrete. Sometimes lobbyists are writing whole pieces of legislation. Sometimes it goes way too far, particularly when it's a business lobby rather than a lobby like an activist movement like Black Lives Matter. But there ain't nothing wrong with telling people what you want. And when you want more, the Black Lives Matter movement has to want more than an apology. I think we should give an apology. I think the United States should apologize for racism. I think the United States should apologize for slavery. I think the United States should apologize for Jim Crow. I see nothing wrong with an apology. Number one, the events happened. No one disputes it. Number two, the events were wrong. Few dispute that. I think well north of 95, 98, hopefully 99% of Americans would agree that slavery was wrong and Jim Crow was wrong today in 2015. So there's nothing wrong with an apology. We can argue about reparations. Should there be any, and how they should be done? But the real question is not the past, but the future, the present, and the future. What needs to change? I want to tell you my agenda for stopping some of this racist violence. My specific agenda in Virginia, and in the nation, and ask you to join in and give me your policy proposals. I'm going to be like Hillary Clinton here and say, what do you suggest? What do we need to do at the legal level to change policies? Because by changing the policies, we can ultimately change the hearts as well. This is Mark Levine. Give me a call. Let me know what you think. 888-488-MARK. 888-488-6275. We'll be right back right after this.
Schooling the GOP, one hand tied behind his back, the Constitution in the other. It's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275.
Back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. So what is the answer? All right. Hillary Clinton says to Black Lives Matter, give me some policy proposals. People say the same to me. All right, Mark, you're going to be a delegate in Virginia. What are your proposals to help dampen down police violence, particularly racist police violence, to help make Black Lives Matter? Or perhaps, as Ernest Pena just tweeted me at Mark Levine Talk, maybe to help make dark lives matter, because as Ernest points out, Hispanics are being covered up a lot. Obviously, police aren't only mistreating black people. So what do we do? Number one, I support police body cameras. I've talked a little bit about that before. I think they protect the truth. They absolutely help protect against police violence of any kind. whether to blacks, Hispanics, whites, Asians, and the American. In fact, we know what happened to Sandra Bland. We know she was unfairly stopped. We don't know what... We know that she didn't do anything wrong when she was stopped. We know that because of a camera. We don't know what happened to make her be murdered in her jail cell. The police would say commit suicide. I'm skeptical. Because there were no cameras. We need cameras. Number one. Number two, we need to stop incarcerating people for nonviolent drug offenses. Think about why you should be incarcerated at all. Well, for crimes of violence, you should be incarcerated. I don't have much sympathy for you. If you beat someone, rape someone, shoot someone, kill someone, stab someone, you should go to jail. Unless you did it with a reason, like self-defense. Protect someone else's life. But you just go around hitting people, you should go to jail. Violence belongs in jail. But why do we punish nonviolence? Well, fraud makes sense. A lot of those Wall Street thieves didn't harm anyone violently, but they destroyed a lot of lives. They stole a lot of money. Theft, embezzlement, fraud. Yeah, I want those people to go to jail too. Absolutely. But drug offenders? When you think about someone who attacks someone and isn't mentally ill, that's a pretty nasty person. They deserve to go to jail, plus we want them off the street. Or someone who defrauds someone. Yeah, a thief. Yeah, we want that person in jail. Because they deserve it and because we don't want them doing that again. But somebody on drugs? Someone who's addicted to substance? It's not a good thing. I'm not praising it. I'm not praising drug addiction, but is it evil? Or is it more sad, even pathetic, that someone learning or trying to escape perhaps other problems in life relies on some substance to take it away and then becomes addicted to that substance? It's pretty pathetic. Why does throwing someone like that in jail? Why do we think that could help anybody? All it really does is take someone who's in need of help and makes a career criminal out of them by putting them with other career criminals that teach them that. So I think we could do a lot about stopping mass incarceration if we stopped putting nonviolent drug offenders behind bars, if we legalized marijuana and taxed it and kept it away from children, at least the extent that we do with cigarettes and alcohol, because it's less harmful than cigarettes and alcohol. And I say that as someone who hates both marijuana and cigarettes, personally. We can ban the box. We can give ex-offenders a chance to rejoin society. One of the worst things to do is to take someone who's just served their time, bring them back into society, not give them a job, not give them a way to make a living, not give them a dime to live on, force them to be homeless or to go back to their old ways because they had a life of crime. They knew from their friends how to burgle houses or how to sell drugs. Note that gang members who commit violence and sell drugs are not the people I'm talking about when I'm talking about nonviolent drug users. They go back to their old way of living, their life of crime, and then we wonder, why did they go back to jail again? So let's help ex-offenders. Let's give people a good education so they see a way to climb out of poverty other than by joining a gang. They see there's a way to make a living. There are real ways to help make black lives and other poor people's lives matter. Body cameras. Don't incarcerate drug offenders, drug users, nonviolent drug users. Give people a chance to come back to society after serving their time. Give people a decent education. These are my proposals. If you have yours, tweet them at me at Mark Levine Talk. We'll talk tomorrow.
Hey there, how you doing? Happy hump day. Welcome, welcome back. Only True Democracy and Talk Radio. We welcome back every second hour, every hump day, my buddy who hosts the hour before this program, Mark Levine. Mark is a former legislative counsel to Democratic Congressman Bonnie Frank and the House Judiciary, Homeland Security, and Financial Services Committees. And he will soon be a delegate. He is a delegate-elect for the great state of Virginia. My buddy Mark Levine is in the house. Hey, Mark, how you doing? Happy hump
day. Hey, I'm doing good. Happy hump day, Leslie.
You know, we were just talking. We should share what we were talking about off the air, okay? You and I are going to talk about the history that was made when two women are going to be graduating from the Army Ranger course, which I, as a chick, am very stoked about. But Mark, you know, our executive producer that we share, he was saying off the air that millennials are perplexed and didn't realize that there were no women in the Navy SEALs or that women didn't fight in combat. My seven-year-old daughter didn't believe me when I told her that there had never been a girl president. I had to say girl, you know, to a seven-year-old.
Right.
Because what she asked me why I was voting for Hillary Clinton, and I wasn't going to go through my ideology politically with a seven-year-old, but I explained to her one of the reasons, I'm not going to lie, is that, you know, she's a woman. And I say this because in 2015, most people just assume, oh, yeah, they can fight in combat. Oh, yeah, they're a Navy SEAL. Oh, yeah, there must have been a female president somewhere. This is the United States of America, for crying out loud. This is history in the making, and kudos to these two women. But women have been trying for decades, not to say anything you can do, I can do better, but anything you can do, I can do if you let me try.
Well, it has been going on for decades. Frankly, I thought around the time that gay and lesbians would be permitted to serve, that women would be allowed into combat. But it was the same people who opposed both. It was the same people who said it's not proper. And my rule is, and I know we'll talk more about it after the break, but my rule has always been hold men and women to the same standards. Now, don't have a lesser standard for women.
Right.
But if you hold men and women to the same standards and the women can do some of those tough physical acts that the men can do, then of course they should be allowed to serve. And frankly, there's some jobs like combat pilot where a smaller, quicker body, you know, you don't need physical strength, but you do need to have a quick mind and be agile and perhaps women would be even better in that role.
I could not get through a day of this. Maybe 2 hours. I couldn't even get – 2 hours would be pushing it. I mean, the kind of, you know, training and the regiment they would have to go through to complete these courses. We'll be back with my buddy and yours, Mark Levine. Pick up the phone and join us. You want to weigh in on the conversation, 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543, talking about two women who've now made history by becoming the first female soldiers to complete their courses at the Army's exhausting Ranger School. And the women, they're graduating this Friday. What next? We'll be back. And like I said, I'm talking with my buddy Mark Levine here, and we're talking about the two women who will graduate from the Army Ranger course this Friday. Mark, what happens now? I mean, this is an exhausting program when you know look at it and read online and research into it, the Army's Ranger School. Now, what happens? I mean, they are the two women, the first two women to ever graduate from this program.
But that doesn't mean that they'll necessarily be in combat.
Right.
Because they are graduates of the program. They've shown they can handle the program. It is exhausting. If you read about it, you see that there's, you know, it's not just sit-ups and pull-ups. It's basically surviving in the forest without much food, parachute jumps, you know, military mountaineering, assaults on helicopters, a 12-mile-foot march, swimming test. You get the idea. You couldn't pass it, Leslie. I couldn't either, and I say that without any real qualification. It's a very grueling test. But just because they passed the test, which, by the way, was the current class started with 381 men and 19 women. And at the end, it was, I'm getting the information right here. I know there were only two women, I think some, 90 men? In any case, just because they passed doesn't mean that they can serve, because there are still rules about women serving in combat, still old sexist rules. And I remember when I used to argue this Here, 94 men, 2 women. So basically, 3 out of 4 men failed, and only these 2 women succeeded. In any case, when I used to argue about this, I used to hear people say, well, you know, women shouldn't be under different standards from men, and it's not fair to have women have strength tests that are less than men's and so forth. And I agree. If the job requires physical strength, the woman needs to have physical strength. Now, there are definitely women stronger than I am. But if it doesn't require physical strength, then it shouldn't have to have it. I don't know how much physical strength it requires to be a combat pilot. It requires dexterity, to be sure. It requires intelligence. But you know, ability to withstand physically being turned around a lot. You know, you can't get dizzy easily. Things like that, but not necessarily your ability to do a bench press. I mean, that's not necessarily something that really would be required to be a combat pilot. So, but as long as the job requires physical strength, then give women and men the same standard. These women passed what they call the men's standard. They passed the same standard. There's no reason not to allow them in combat roles.
I agree. Do you think that this will be the beginning of that?
I do. The other example they gave, and by the way, saying they couldn't pass the physical test is at least a reasonable thing to say. Again, unreasonable in the sense that there are women who can pass these physical tests, but it's reasonable to demand they pass a physical test. There was also an unreasonable argument that used to be made when I worked for Barney Frank on this issue, and that was, oh, well, if women are in combat, then men will rush in to save them, and they'll lose their lives because men are so chivalrous, and they'll run in to save a woman before they'd run in to save a man, and they'll risk their own lives, which I thought was a really insulting argument on a number of fronts. For one thing, men save men in combat all the time and should save men. If we have someone wounded and you can save that person's life by pulling them to safety, then you should do that, whether it's a man or a woman. And frankly, if you can't go without being shot to save a life, then you shouldn't, because you'll be dead too. So that's reasonable whether it's a man or a woman. And this idea, it was the same thing about gay men in the military, that, oh, no, gay men can't serve because they'll be looking at other men the whole time. You know, as if
yeah, men, like when you're dying after doing 100 push-ups, you know. I mean, I'm sure a guy's thinking, look at the rack on that one. Or
exactly.
That the woman's going, man, I just hope later he asks me out. Please, we're smarter than that. Are we really that shallow? And I guess there unfortunately are some people who really are that shallow. Now, this was the first year that the Army opened the course to women. This was done on a trial basis. Again, peeking behind the curtain at the inevitability of the future, perhaps.
Yeah, and it's an insult to straight men, just like it's an insult to gay men to say they can't concentrate on their military duties because there are other men around. It's an insult to straight men to say they can't concentrate on their military duties because there are women around. It's just insulting. These are professional. These are some of the highest professionals we have. Our military is the best in the world, and they really shouldn't be insulted by these people saying they can't concentrate. There's someone of another gender around. Please.
Let's take some calls from a man. No, I'm just. let's start it out with Jim in Las Vegas, line 3. Hi, Jim. Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us. What's your take on this?
Hi, Leslie. Hey, this is very similar to why they don't allow transgender people in the military.
That's true.
Yeah.
And Caitlin is a perfect example of that.
And that policy is wrong. Because I think that these professionals can handle and do their job no matter who they're serving with. Frankly, the argument used to be made about letting blacks in the military, that white men won't be able to serve. When Harry Truman desegregated the military in 1948, a number of people said, you know, the Southern soldiers won't be able to serve with black people. And it's true. A few Southern white racist guys said, I won't serve with blacks, and they were either court-martialed or left the military. But the vast majority of a white guy said, yeah, whatever, you gave me orders, I'm in the military, I'll follow them. So this idea that prejudice should trump service never made sense to me.
Now, did you see on TV, on the news last night, what these women, all the people have to go through? I mean, it is not well, Leslie said that in the beginning. I mean, I don't think a man can pass that, and if a woman can, then she should be able to go to combat.
Right, 3/4 of the men failed. Three-quarters of the men failed, and 17 out of the 19 women failed.
But and, Leslie, I agree with you on the first rip about the guy that molested those kids.
Subway, Jared Fogel. Yeah.
I'm a gay man, and I was molested by a priest when I was a child. And I enjoy my gay life, but it's with men, not with children.
Yeah.
And it's the most disgusting thing to see what happened with that guy. So he should go away for a long, long time.
I agree. I agree.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for your call and contribution today, Jim. Appreciate it. Let's go to Reggie in Georgia, line one. Reggie, a comment on this?
Yes, I would just like to know who Mark Levine said that somebody was insulting these women earlier, that if they take over the military, you know, if they fight in combat, that men won't be men anymore. They won't, you know, they have to go and save them before they go save their male comrades or buddies or whatnot. Did you hear that on Fox News or Rush Limbaugh or anybody?
I'll tell you who I heard it from. I heard it from back when I worked in Congress, and this is already about 12 years ago now. Right. There was an organization, and I don't want to misquote it. I think it may be Elaine Donnelly's organization, it may be someone else, but there was an organization that was opposed to women in combat, and they made the most sexist arguments possible, basically that men are so chivalrous that they'll forget their military duties and just run out and get shot to save the woman in distress. And it's really offensive to everybody concerned, to the women who are fighting, to the men who are, you know, who would save them. I just don't think the military acts on the basis of gender or should act on the basis of gender. Obviously, people in the military should look out for each other, but it doesn't matter whether they're male or female.
Right, and as I said to Andrew, Leslie's call screen and yours too just earlier, they tried out, and if they pass and graduate, fine, and if they didn't make it, you know, at least they tried. But don't deny them, don't keep them from trying out. Don't discriminate against them.
And, well, these two women apparently are incredible. I mean, they're incredible, physically, mentally. They'd be fantastic in the job.
Oh, no question about it. Reggie, anything else?
Yeah, but you still have a lot of these Rush Limbaugh, Archie Bunker, Fox News Channel types in the world who are, the misogynistic, chauvinist, and sexist pigs. Oh, yeah, and let alone a certain former reality TV talk, TV show host who's running for president, D.T., you know what I'm saying?
He's
also a sexist pig, right, Leslie?
I think Donald Trump is a sexist pig, but it's weird because he contradicts himself all the time. He's a sexist pig, but he happens to be pro-choice, supports Planned Parenthood and women's rights to reproduction and access to clinics and things like that. Reggie, thank you for the call. Darlin, next time, please don't call us on a speakerphone. Andrew, you're going to make sure he picks up his landline because I felt like we were in the hollow echo chamber there. Hey, Mark Levine, you know what? They tried this on a trial basis. Is the Army saying anything right now that alludes to this trial becoming permanent to open the course to women in the future? And, you know, if this does happen, obviously these two women are to be thanked for that.
No, but I can't imagine they won't. This is a time when now transgender people are being allowed to serve, and they should be allowed to serve. And this ancient prohibition against women in combat roles, I think, will end very shortly as well. So
you know what amazes me, Mark, and you and I know we've heard these people on TV, on radio. We see them tweet on the Twitter page, call the radio program, you know, about how terrible Islam is to its women. Right. Saudi Arabia, they won't let them vote or they won't let them drive. Make them wear a burqa. And it's like we've never had a woman president. Almost anything with regard to, women with legislation, the conservatives try to, appeal, push back, derail, undo. And we have never had women fighting in combat. Yet historically, we have seen other cultures and civilizations use women to fight in combat because they know they're a part of their society and they need every person that they can.
Absolutely. In fact, Israel has been drafting its women pretty much ever since its founding in 1948.
Yep.
There are women in the European militaries. But I won't say we're as bad as Saudi Arabia. We're not that far down, but we're getting there. I believe within 1 year the combat prohibition will be removed. That's my
prediction. We're not Saudi Arabia, but I mean America's pretty sexist considering we're a Western world.
We're definitely more sexist than Europe. I'll give you that.
We're saying, oh my God, they're forcing a woman to dress that way, but you know what? The United Arab Emirates had a fighter pilot who dropped her bombs. She dropped the bomb on ISIS, baby, right? She literally wiped their asses off the planet.
No question about it. And hey, Leslie, one thing, Donald Trump may have been pro-choice, but he says he's pro-life now. Now tomorrow he may go back to being pro-choice.
Yeah, it's however the polls go, the wind is blowing.
Exactly.
Yeah, what does his tarot card reader say? Yeah, that's true. Hey, Mitt Romney did that too when he was in Massachusetts running for governor. He was pro-choice, and then all of a sudden, he's pro-life. I wonder if we call him today if he knows what he is.
Yeah, no. So I don't think he does. I just didn't want people to think that Donald Trump is this liberal. What he is he's a.
He came out supporting Planned Parenthood, though.
He didn't. He's been on both sides of that, I guess is what I want to say. He didn't come out and say that he opposed the cutting of funding, but he didn't say he supported the cutting of funding either. I think he's just avoiding the topic, basically.
Oh, that wasn't what I read.
Well, what I read was that when they asked him if he'd ever given to Planned Parenthood, he said he didn't think he had, but he'd given to thousands of charities, and he may have given to them, and he kind of poo-pooed the whole question. But
in July of last year, he said that Planned Parenthood, quote, absolutely be defunded. Then he suggested last week, that he could support continued federal funding of Planned Parenthood, and then he also called the videos terrible. He said, quote, his pro-life views will attract women. And that's actually 5 hours ago. But then again, he also said he also defended Planned Parenthood. So again, yeah.
So if you and I are confused on Donald Trump's position, it's not your and my fault. It's because Donald Trump's been all over the map.
Very true. Okay, buddy, always good to talk with you. Check out Mark's website, marklevinetalk.com. Follow him on Twitter, @MarkLevineTalk, and listen to him every weekday, 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Leslie Marshall Show Network. We are going to take a break. Talk Radio News Service comes up next, and I think Ellen Ratner, Washington Bureau Chief for TRNS, will be joining us.